Okay, I want today to do the impossible and talk about urbanization and urban growth in 50 minutes, but it builds on what you're reading, and I'll give the classic example, which is the greatest project of intervention, of human intervention or rebuilding, that is the rebuilding of Paris by that man that my late friend Richard Cobb once dissed as the Alsatian Attila. But in doing so, I want to emphasize a couple points. One is that the 19th century was a period of phenomenal urban growth and urbanization. I will distinguish those in a minute. And secondly, that one of the things that emerges out of this urban growth and urbanization, but particularly the growth of cities, large and small and medium, in the 19th century is an increasing geography of class segregation. And the theme, of course, in Paris, as in other cities, London's a good example, is a more prosperous West and a increasingly less prosperous East. But also, one of the things that I really enjoy talking about and trying to help people understand is why it is that European suburbs are not at all like American suburbs. Why is it that sort of people feared by elites were perched on the edge of European cities, whether it's Vienna, whether it's Paris, whether it's lots of other places, and not in the center, whereas in the United States, you know, if you think of the riots in 1967, before your time, most of your times, in Detroit, or Newark, or in Watts, or East LA, it was people in the center with the wealthy people in the periphery, sort of fearing the poor people living in the center. Why is it just completely different? I remember in about, I don't know, the 1990s, early 1990s, we're doing a book, just a bunch of essays in France called Banlieue Rouge, which means sort of red suburbs, and I was supposed to write something sort of tying the book together, and it was at this time of the Rodney King trial, and most of you are not of the trial of Rodney King, but when Rodney King, who was an Afro-American who was beaten up by cops in L.A., and it was filmed by somebody who just happened to have a camera and was filming this, and there was a big trial. And the police who beat the hell out of him were acquitted, you know, and they were acquitted by a white jury in the suburbs. And so and people in France couldn't get over that, the idea of sort of wealthy people living in the suburbs as opposed to poor people living in the suburbs in Europe. And so we had to sort of hold the book for, you know, for a couple weeks or till I could figure out how to explain this. And so that's one theme also under the rubric of center and periphery. And why are European cities different? Well, human intervention has something to do with that in the case of Paris, and that's fun to talk about, and so I'm going to do that in the last half of the talk. But a few points at the beginning, and I sent around, I hope it will reach you, something I sent out at 10:16 on this class server, which has most of these terms on the board. Okay, the 19th century is a period of both urban growth and urbanization. Why are those different? Urban growth is, say, well, population of any city, population of Vienna rises from, say, 500,000 to a million. I don't remember the statistics. That is urban growth. You know, Vienna is bigger at the end of the 19th century than it was at the beginning of the 19th century. Or any place you want to pick. But the most important point is that there's urbanization in the 19th century. So you could have urban growth, absolutely, and de-urbanization if at the end of any period that you're looking at you had more people living in cities, but they represented a smaller percentage of the population. So you could actually have de-urbanization if you had more people living in the countryside at the end of the period relatively to those living in the cities. But it depends on how you define what is an urban area. You know, in the case of France, which we know where they have all these great censuses all the time, in the Restoration, that is 1815-1830, a city had 1,500 people in it. There's that many people lined up at the Milford Mall when it opens, you know, in this country. In 1841, they start using 2,000 people agglomerated, that is living in an urban, you know, little church, the steeple, open up the church and look at all the people, or whatever. But you know what I mean? That's an urban area. You know, in the United States, I have no idea what a city it used to be 5,000. I think it may be 25,000, something like that. It doesn't matter. Depending on what you call urban, defined as urban, there's a remarkable increase in the urban population in the 19th century. And it's not just big, huge cities like Naples or Constantinople or London, which is so enormous compared to Paris, compared to anyone, any city, spatially. But it's also small towns that increase in size because of industrial, commercial, administrative functions. I mean, so all this is perfectly obvious, but it's the 19th century is the growth of big, big cities and the first conurbations, that is, cities that just sort of run into each other, such as now, for example, you know, Boston to Washington is practically a conurbation. I mean, France would be Lille, Tourcoing, Roubaix. You know, in north of England, it would be Manchester and its expanding suburbs. All right, that's all perfectly obvious. So the next step is to say, now, where does the population of cities come from? I mean, who are all these people that are increasing the population of cities and are part of this process of in a statistical sense, of urban growth? And second point that I'll make is, what did people think about this? I mean, what did they think about these teeming cities? Teeming was a word that they started to use to describe these cities. This seemed to be kind of runaway cities. Okay, first of all, I'm not going to write this on the board because it's probably, but despite the fact it's the only mathematical formula that I even know, that if you were trying to explain the growth of any city from point one in time to point two in time, what you do is simply look at the population at point one in time, say 1811 or something like that, and then you try to find out where the population came from that increased it to point two in time. You know, if the city reclassified what was considered urban, if they annexed its suburbs, that's what Lyon does in 1852 or Paris does in 1860 on January 1st, or almost anywhere they do this, then that would be one factor. Then you would have births minus deaths. I mean, do you have a natural increase in population? And then the other thing is in versus out migration. Do you have more people arriving in the city than leaving it? I mean, there are people leaving and people arriving all the time. But if you look at particularly the first half of the 19th century, to make a generalization, it was hot in here, to make a generalization, more people die in cities than are born there, because cities are very unhealthy places, which helps create this kind of image of biological sickness that I'll discuss in a minute, that I'll evoke with some conservative commentators from those times. What do I mean by that? Well, the average life expectancy in Manchester, counting infant mortality, so it's a little bit exaggerates, was about 19 years old. So you guys would have about had it. Or Lille, in the north of France, it's the same thing. That's pretty young, but that counts life expectancy. If you made it to the ripe old age of, say, 18, then your chances of living longer were pretty great. And you still had places where you have phenomenal, still cases, particularly in areas where you have all these spinsters, in Brittany and in Ireland, you know, of old women who live a very long time. And of course, women lived and still live longer than men. So another reason why you have more people, you know, dying in cities, or among other reasons, is infanticide. You know, foundling homes in these big cities, you name the big city, Rome, Berlin, anywhere you want, St. Petersburg, Moscow, they have huge foundling homes with thousands and thousands of babies abandoned every year. One third of those babies die before the end of the next year. Infanticide, the church, which you know, obviously opposes infanticide and obviously opposes abortion in the 19th century, what they do is they finally agree to have, they put in these little things called tours, T-O-U-R-S. They're like, you know, this awful example to give, and it comes out of an institution that no longer exists, Machine City. But any place that you have those kind of machines and you put money in and you hope that the window is going to turn around and actually give you your M&Ms, that's what, you know, to make a crass example, that's what one of these tours were. They encouraged people to, you know, young women, usually unmarried or uncoupled women, to abandon their babies instead of exposing them and having them die. But foundling homes are, so they, you put your baby in this, you ring the bell, you put the baby in this little thing that turns around, and then the good sister comes and takes the baby into the foundling home, and if all goes well, the baby will be there in a year, but one third of them are not there in a year. So you got a lot of people, a lot of babies who die. And this increases the mortality rate. Then you've also got a lot of old people who come into the cities and young people to beg seeking those last vestiges of charity, you know, who are clutching at passersby as they go to church, and who some people give their money and most of the people don't give the money. Often they form part of the community, which is obviously the case here, at Yale. Of course, a lot of them, the older people die, and they find, you know, a policeman going on his rounds in any city, in Milan or Turin or anywhere, we're going to find dead people the next morning. So you've got more people die in cities than are born there, really in most places, way into the 19th century. So the point is, obviously, that it's immigration that brings, that causes urbanization and urban growth. Massive immigration, usually from the hinterland, that is the region around around cities. I mean, in the case of Berlin, I mean, northern Germans from Brandenburg or Pomerania, many, many Poles moving into Berlin, very poor people moving into Berlin. In the case of Paris, people who come into Paris are from Normandy or from Champagne, or from central France, where a lot of them are seasonal migrants and ended up living there permanently. In the 1880s, you've got a huge wave of Bretons from Brittany who don't speak French. And if you go to the station of Montparnasse, you'll see a lot of the cafes around Montparnasse are named after Breton towns. À la ville de Saint-Brieuc, à la ville de Nantes. And when you still today at that station, Montparnasse, you see the first thing you see when you get off a train there is a sign for the assistance, public assistance for Bretons. And it's in the station of Montparnasse. And this is certainly true. Marseille, the population of Marseille, it includes lots of people from the south of France, from Provence, but also who? Italians. So this is very obvious. You know, Catalans who move into, people who move into Barcelona are far more likely to be Catalan than they are to be Galician or Castilian or something. This is all obvious. There's no surprises there. But the image that people had of this rapid migration into cities of poor people, because the majority of people who moved to these cities are poorer than the people that are already there. This was in the case of the 1950s and 60s in most of these cities. It's not the case, the 1950s and 60s. So young professional couples who get enough money to come to rent an apartment in London, good luck, or to buy an apartment in London or in Berlin or someplace else or Munich. But in the 19th century, you have waves of poor people, the kinds of people you've seen before, who are coming to work as domestic servants, coming to work as day laborers. In the case of London, coming to work on the teeming, there's that word again, docks of the Thames River, as London is that imperial city looking out on its vast empire. Interesting thing about London, wish we had days to talk about this stuff, but that it's really only in London that you had people of color. You could find them already by the end of the 19th century, people coming from, from India, from Pakistan, what would become Pakistan, people coming from the Caribbean, where is in other cities, you simply didn't have that. I mean, the number of North Africans coming to Paris is merely a trickle, really until after World War I. But anyway, so contemporaries had the idea that what this whole process was, and I should have written this on the board, but you can write it down if you would please, called the uprooting hypothesis. They didn't call it that. That's sort of social science from the 1960s. That these people were uprooted from those steady rural roots of organized religion and from family support, and they're thrown into the maelstrom, into the chaos, sometimes a creative chaos, but nonetheless the perception was a dangerous chaos that was urban life. And the result of all of this was that revolution becomes seen as an extension of purse snatching. In fact, some of the bad social science from the 1960s in trying to explain, the riots in Detroit and places like that said, well, you've got a lot of poor people coming from Alabama and Arkansas, which is certainly the case, or from South and North Carolina, move up to Detroit and try to get a job in the factories there. And then, wow, they get to Detroit, they just freak out. because those rural roots have been cut. I mean, you still see this in various electoral campaigns, even today, even as I speak. This sort of idea that, you know, cosmopolitanism, you know, which is also, by the way, in almost every language, sort of a class, sort of a code word for anti-Semitism. And when people say, "Oh, cities are so cosmopolitan," they meant they are full of Jews. And this is particularly true in this sort of anti-Semitism and racism of Eastern and Central Europe, where you had such a large Jewish population living in cities like Prague, Budapest, Vilnius, Riga, just about anywhere you could name. And then with the kind of increase in ethnic populations, with the Estonization of Tallinn or the Czechization of Prague, you had fewer Germans and fewer Jews living in those cities, but you had this sort of anti-Semitic discourse that lingers. Vienna is the classic case, because Vienna goes from being sort of liberal city in the 1850s and 60s to sort of a hotbed of anti-Semitism, where the mayor of Vienna at the end of the 19th century, a buffoon called Karl Luger, says, "I say who's a Jew." That's one of his most infamous statements. "I say, declare who's a Jew and who isn't." And of course, one wants to understand how Adolf Hitler got his anti-Semitism. It really comes from World War I, but the basis was already laid there by growing up in Austria in the 1890s, in the first decade of the 20th century. So anyway, but if you think about that, you know, does immigration, this massive immigration, necessarily lead to urban chaos? Well, the answer is obviously not. Because we have the effect that now we know a lot about, historians and social scientists and social geographers and sociologists, and it's called chain migration. Take the case of China, that people who have studied Beijing, you know, discovered a long time ago. I mean, I remember this from days when I was studying Chinese history back at less mighty Michigan than it was before. You know, all these people pouring into Beijing in the 19th century, where they formed native place associations. Wei Quan, I can't remember, it was something like that was the term. And so it's obvious, you get together with people that you know from your part of China, and they are sort of the intermediaries between you and the city. The Irish are a classic case. We already have seen how the British leaders scare the hell out of the Irish because they're Catholic and all that. But they don't just pour into Manchester and Liverpool and London and sort of freak out. It doesn't work like that at all. They live with their families. Their families make a little money and say, "Why don't you come along?" It's the same thing. Look at the case of Americans, you know, people coming to the United States at the end of the 19th century. First of all, massively from northern Italy, and then the 20th century from southern Italy. You know, they send money back all the time. It's very different than the German Germans who came to the United States almost never were in contact with their families again, relatively. And same with Swiss, but the Italians were always stayed in contact. But in any case, all these people, it's very sensible. If you come from, you know, California to Yale, you know, if there are a couple of high schools in LA that send all these students to Yale, and if you're kind of, you know, you're kind of freaking out when you get to Yale, I think, God, all these people, whatever, they're all so smart or whatever. And then, you know, the next thing you do is that you go to people that you wouldn't even say hello to in high school and say, "Well, you know, why don't we hang out tonight," or something like that. And so you find people that come have sort of origins like you, geographic or whatever, and hang out with them. It's a logical thing. It happens every single time. In the case of people moving to Paris, Limousin, people from the center part of Paris, of France, called the Limousin. You know, they live in certain neighborhoods around the center of Paris, in the way that Bretons lived around what became the Gare Montparnasse, the station of Montparnasse. So this is chain migration. You see it in Philadelphia, you see it in London, you see it in Moscow, you see it in St. Petersburg, you see it everywhere. But having said that, that's not the way contemporaries viewed this. Qu'est-ce que j'ai fait moi? Voilà. Okay, let me just give you a couple examples of how often well-meaning, but not always, contemporaries saw the phenomenon of urbanization and urban growth. Let's listen to a preacher called James Shergold Boone, minister of St. John's Church in the Paddington District of London. This is a sermon. And when he's talking about cities, he's evoking Sodom and Gomorrah. The very extent of edifices and the very collection of vast masses of human of human beings onto one spot, humanity remaining what it is, bad is what he means, must be fraught with moral infection. They continually use words like infection, that there's a biological inequality of people with each other, that poor are biologically less likely to, in a world of where Darwin and post-Darwin and misuse of Darwin is very important, to survive the challenges of illness, of disease, and illness, the cholera carries away poor people more than rich people. He says, to go back to the good minister, cities are the centers and theaters of human ambition, human cupidity, human pleasure. On the one side, the appetites, the passions, the carnal corruptions of man are forced as in a hot bed, into a rank and foul luxuriance, and countless evils, which would otherwise have a feeble and difficult existence, are struck out into activity and warmth. This is biological contagion. This is a disease metaphor, constantly, by mere contact with each other. On the one side, on the other side, many constraints and safeguards are weakened or even withdrawn. This is what I mean by leaving those imaginary rural roots in which solidarity was considered to be automatic and family support so very, very important. In cities, he goes on, there is a complication of evils. External forces cooperate with inward desires. You can conquer those inward bad desires in the countryside, but all is lost in the demon rum of moral corruption. That is, the reality is from urban life. Well, et cetera, et cetera. Sir Charles Shaw, who was police chief of Manchester, described the residents of industrial cities. These quotes come from an excellent book by a guy at Rutgers, Camden, called Elise, whose wife teaches at Penn. He called the residents of industrial cities, such as his own, as the debris which the vast whirlpool of human affairs has deposited here in one of its eddies, associated but not united, contiguous but not connected. That's a perfect description of the uprooting hypothesis, that there's nothing you can do to save people from themselves. Or to take an example from Paris, because I'm going to talk about Paris in a while. In the 1830s, a certain Vicomte de Launay, quite forgettable, exclaimed, "How ugly Paris seems after 1 year away, how one stifles in these dark, damp, narrow corridors, damp," again, that's a sort of key word in all this, "which you are pleased to call the streets of Paris. One would think that it was an underground city, so sluggish in the air, so profound the obscurity. And thousands of people live, bustle, throng in the liquid darkness like reptiles in a marsh." Or Victor Hugo, "Cities like forests have their dens in which hide all the vilest and most terrible monsters." Well, all this ferocious. It couldn't be any more condemning than, particularly in Germany, where the whole sense of Heimat, of having a hometown, of being attached to a particular space, and all of the corruption that comes from big cities, and you see this over and over again. Or take New York. Here's another reverend, the Reverend Amory D. Mayo, who attacked the city. "All the dangers of the town may be summed up here, that here, withdrawn from the blessed influence of nature, that is, out of the country, and set face to face against humanity, mankind loses his own nature and becomes a new and artificial creature, an unhuman cog in a social machinery that works like fate." Again, in Zola, the theme of fate is terribly, terribly important, of destiny, along with, as you'll see, along with people that have those, or if you read other Zola, they have the bad genes, they've got the drinking genes, or whatever. You find all this appalling stuff. Here's another one. In a book, a lecture in 1844, "The Young Americans, the cities drain the country of the best part of its population, the flower of its youth, of both sexes. They go into the town and the country is cultivated by so much inferior class." Well, et cetera, et cetera. That was the image, and of course all of the revolutions have a lot to do with that. Simon, I can't find my wand. Is it up there?
It should be in the podium
underneath. Ah. Yes. It's not. Voila. Yeah. Can you do it? Or?
Yeah.
Thanks. Okay, now let's look at an example of this. I'm sorry, I can't click them. I was going to have to wave my hands frenetically or something, or jump up and down. Now, I want you to look at Paris and think about what I've said. This is Paris in 1839. Compared to London, I don't have time to talk about this. In London, you can walk miles, and you're still staggering around looking for the next tube stop, because it's about three times as big, at least three times as big physically. Paris, 1837, you could walk from the Arc de Triomphe, which is up on the left, to the end in about an hour and a half, and this is before the inner suburbs are annexed for tax reasons, but also for reasons of imposing order on the troublesome periphery, and this is part of the lecture. So what you've got is, if you know Paris at all, it doesn't matter if you don't know Paris, here's the Garden of Luxembourg, you've got the Tuileries up along the Seine there, you got your basic Seine River, you did have three islands, now they're but two, they cemented that one over, Ile Saint-Louis there, which is now one of the great sort of tourist traps in Western civilization, but it's still beautiful. And there's Cité with old Notre Dame right in the middle. You've got an enormous population. You've got in the central district three times the density of population that you have now. We have an apartment in the Marais, a couple blocks up from Notre Dame, and the density there in the 1840s in this neighborhood, which was called Arcy then, was three times what it is now. So you've got this enormous implosion of people into the center from the provinces. Next one, please. Voilà. Now, the reason I put this up is this is the first photo of Paris. This is what you call the daguerreotype, daguerreotype, and then I can identify this as, I'm sure not the only one, but this is the faubourg. A faubourg is an English word too, as well as French. It means it's sort of an extension of the town. It's a difficult etymology. It doesn't really come from false bourg, but from other things. It's beyond the walls. But this is the first one. This is also from about 1837. Now, Haussmann, the Alsatian Attila, he built these boulevards that became the staging ground for the so-called Belle Époque. But there were also boulevards anywhere, like around, because the boulevards were where the walls had once been. Vienna is a great example. The rings around Vienna were the rings that had been where the walls were that were knocked down as the city grew. In Berlin, you find the same thing. Next, please. This is cheating a little bit. Unhealthy. This is just unhealthy. This is an 18th century hat. Look at the guy. There's a 19th century guy looking progressively forward to the 19th century with this bourgeois outfit. This could be the Restoration, actually. And he's going to get hit by, it's raining, he says, but it's not. It's a chamber pot being dumped on his head. In the 1860s, only about 10% of buildings had water above the second floor. Next, please. This is by a guy called Charles Marion. It doesn't matter. But the point of this is Cité, and there's Notre Dame there before Viollet-le-Duc's big flesh spire on it. The point is that before the rebuilding of Paris, this was among the most densely populated parts of Paris. At the end of the period, that is 1870, it's the least densely populated part of Paris because they remember capitalism in the state? They build government buildings. Well, the hospital, the Hôtel Dieu, is one of them. The prefecture of police, which would have all the fighting around it in 1944, in August, was built as well. So these places disappear. And the morgue, one of the more important morgues was here also. And so that was sort of, again, gave the idea of the disease of the center city. Next, please. Name those people. There we go. Paris in the left, it's 1850. Paris on the right, they're all running together. But you see, there's a lot more people. And you have the growth, the filling in of the center, and you've got the periphery with the emergence of these suburbs. And it's the suburbs that have increasingly poor people living in them who can't afford to live in the center of Paris. That's the big difference. That's a big, big difference. You have a customs barrier around Paris. Every time you bring things into the city or any other French city, you have to pay taxes on them. A six-pack of beer, you pay a tax. You have more space outside the city walls, so that's where you build factories. You're nearer to canals and to railroads, so that's where you build factories. The center city throws the unwanted industries, the dirty industries, soap, chemicals, etc., outside. Paris doesn't de-industrialize. You still have the garment industry. But the dirty industries, the big industries on the outside, and that's where your labor force lives. So that how different that is than Philadelphia or Detroit, where you already had all the space and you've got the population moving into big central areas and essentially staying there. Now, to be sure, in the United States, we have, you know, you have places like very small part of New Orleans, you've got San Francisco, you've got Beacon Hill, you've got Manhattan, you've got sort of places where you've got a lot of wealthy people living in the center city, but places like Detroit are more really common of the American experience. Next, please. And I can remember when I was a kid, I was younger than you, I think, going to a Yankee-Tiger doubleheader in 1967. Roy White played third base, and we walked out and the city was on fire. Of Detroit because of the riots, and it's still all burned out there. And one of the interesting things was Grosse Pointe, Michigan, which is a very fancy place. We have a lot of students here from Grosse Pointe. I'm not dissing Grosse Pointe, Michigan, but the municipal council tried to figure out a way that you couldn't get to Grosse Pointe from the center of Detroit unless you had a map, unless you really knew how to get there. Try to keep them, that is the poor people of the center, from going to the suburbs. And the upper classes of Grosse Pointe armed themselves with their hunting rifles and, you know, just as the constables had in central London in 1848. I mean, the spatial juxtaposition is incredible. Next, oh, here we go. Those were lots of people in the center. The theme here is overcrowding. Here's the market of the innocents, it was called. Now it's down by the Forum des Halles. Lots of people. Then the big market Haussmann built. Would later be torn down, but lots of people in the middle, that's the theme. Next, please. And the Rue Pirouette in 1860. Now, these are really old medieval buildings, and of course, a lot of them get destroyed by the rebuilding. Next, please. This is a good one, because this is one of the streets that would disappear, and you could say, well, what the hell is he talking about? Where are all those people? Well, if you have really good eyes, you can see that there are a few people here because of these long exposures. There's actually some people standing there. But this had already been condemned to be destroyed, rather like the Rue Transnonain, that it had part of the collective memory of the massacre there. What is this in the center? Well, it's a ditch down which sewage went. There were some sewers in Paris, but it was very unhealthy. And in these areas, this is right near the Pantheon, that is in the sort of center left eastern part of Paris. The people just get destroyed by the cholera in 1832 and again in 1849 and again in the 1880s, in 1884. Fundamental inequality before death of the poor. And so this street, this is actually a great photo. This is by a guy called Charles Malville who went around and took pictures of these neighborhoods that were going to disappear. Don't worry about the names, don't worry about the streets. I'm trying just to make a point. But not everybody lived on those streets. In the Second Empire, that is 1852 to 1870, Napoleon III, people lived it up. And a lot of Zola's novels are really, you know, kind of amazing about that. And he didn't like Louis Napoleon terribly much. This is living it up in a big, a big banquet in a big hotel. Already you can see the wine glasses. They're starting to put the wine glasses in connection with the food. That's something really comes in the 19th century, the idea of having, you know, red wine with cheese. So you do have white wine with goat's cheese, but having white wine with with fish and with fowl and that kind of thing. And these long, elaborate banquets of one course following another. I mean, I can hardly condemn that, having sat through a few thousand of them myself. But anyway, there we go. Fancy people. Next, please. Now this is revolution in 1830. Now the bourgeois guy, he doesn't belong there because he never went out there anyway. Marianne, this is a highly romantic view of death. Here's your street urchin there who's fighting the good fight in 1830. This is Delacroix's famous Liberty Leading the People. This is an enormous, enormous painting. And then these people look like they're kind of play acting. They're kind of say, oh, well, I'm dead now. And then a few minutes later, they're going to get up again. This is very romanticized. Next, please. Compare this to Meissonier. This is a very underappreciated painting. Again, the name doesn't matter. It meant to him, and it does to art people. But this is called The Barricade. This is only 18 years later. This is 1848. This is real death. These are ordinary people. And again, look at the gray-green, the sick quarters. But this is an affectionate look at people who are dying for a good cause in the center of Paris. But Louis Napoleon III, didn't want revolution again. And since there were barricades in so many of these revolutions, you know, barricades begin on the day of the barricades in Paris, what's that, 1572 or something like that, before this course stokes up. He said, let's build the barricades, the boulevards so wide that you can't build barricades across them. In 1944 and in 1968, barricades were in the same places often where the revolutionary barricades had been in 1789 or in 1848 or in 1871. Next, please. So these guys, that's Napoleon, the guy with the pen. That's Osman, who was born in Paris, but an Alsatian parent. He's in the middle there. And Louis Napoleon flops a map down and says, build big boulevards through this teeming city. Teeming used for the third time. He does it for three reasons. One, two, three. One, to bring more air into Paris. More boulevards with sewers underneath them. Boulevards mean better transportation. More light. Secondly, he does this to increase the flow of capital. It's not a coincidence that department stores are built on these boulevards, and some of the ones are still there. The shopkeepers not near department stores got wiped out, and they got really mad. Very extreme right-wing voting at the end of the 19th century. The ones near the department stores do very, very well. And third, and he says it in his memoirs, he builds them. Louis Napoleon, Osman's memoirs, I'm talking about, wants these built so you can't have barricades. And he builds these boulevards around and through the traditional revolutionary areas, and the result is lots of people pack up and they leave. Next, we're going to go through the next fairly quick. So here's Paris, 1855. Now, Belleville up there, or La Villette, or Montmartre there, which has a god-awful church, Sacré-Cœur, built on it after 1871, those were annexed as suburbs in 1860. They were its inner suburbs annexed into Paris. And so this wall here is the limit of Paris today. But you still have people farming in Vaugirard and these places, Grenelle. But all of that will stop. And by 1870, then this is all sort of packed with people. And the people living in Belleville, which is on a hill, were people who, many of whom were forced out of the central quarters by high rents. And so they are the ones perched dangerously from the point of view of the center on the periphery. And ironically, as the middle classes move further and further west, they lose their contact with ordinary people. And for a lot of the stuff they're reading is based upon, they don't really see those people up there. Maybe they walk down the hill. They can't afford to take the omnibus, the horse-drawn carriages, to be servants in their houses. But these spatial things are very, very interesting, and you find them in other cities too. So here, they take the map and they say, let's build boulevards. And you don't have to know anything about Paris to know that there wasn't any north-south, north is up there, south is down toward me, thoroughfare, and they built Boulevard Saint-Michel, Boulevard Strasbourg, Boulevard Saint-Denis that goes up to the station of the east with the station of the north right to the left. The Étoile up here, you know, the boulevards help create the kind of star notion. The Étoile means star. It looks like a star around the Arc de Triomphe, and the big grand crossing that I'll show you in a minute that gives you the west-east access as well as some other ones too. So they do a lot of building. They knock down a whole hill. This is now where the Palace of Trocadero is. Lots of work employing lots of people, so the housing workers like them. 1855, let's look at, you're walking through the Gallery of Machines at one of these world fairs, because Victoria had one in 1851, Louis Napoleon's got to have them too, so he has two. He has one in 1855 and another one in, what is it, 66 or 67. So you're walking along here and you can look at paintings, or above all you can look at machines, you can look at things that you can buy. That's the principle of these expositions. Paris is on stage. And that's the principle of a department store. You can walk through a department store and you can buy 49 different kinds of shawls, ranging from very cheap ones to very expensive ones. It's the same principle. And so the boulevards are really an extension of, as my friend Philip Nord once argued, and so have a lot of other people, of these department stores themselves. And they become sort of the staging area for what became known as the Belle Époque. It wasn't so belle for people that didn't have any money, because those were hard economic times. And these department stores still exist. I mean, the BHV, Bazaar de l'Hôtel-Ville, still exists in Paris. Bon Marché, there's a terrific book on Bon Marché by Michael Miller on the Bon Marché. It's still there. And Zola called them the cathedrals of modernity. And already in the 1850s, they had singing groups singing Christmas carols at Christmas. People would come that couldn't afford to buy anything and just be part of the spectacle. Paris became a spectacle in itself, and the boulevards were part of that. These aren't very good prints, but it's called, this is called, he was so important he became, to Osman something was to bulldoze it. Maybe to Merriman something will be to drink a good bottle of Cote de Rhone. Maybe one day that'll be my, I'll get a French verb. But anyway, Osman, I'm just kidding. Osmanization is to bulldoze something. And so this is called the Osmanization of a neighborhood. And here, these people are getting the equivalent of about $10, forced out of their houses. They've got their dog. They've got everything they own there. Look at the mattress. Mattress is the last thing you ever pawn. There's the mattress, and they're leaving. And then the next one, please. This is called Osman Part 2. And here you've got your Osmanian vista. You've got the big boulevards with all these not then so fancy railings, balcony railings. The real fancy ones come later in the Third Republic. And this is really San Augustin. It's a hideous church. So some people really like it. My dear friend Bob Herbert thinks it's not bad, the art historian. But this is Osmanization of a quarter, part two of a neighborhood. Next, please. And you've got people building. That's the Tour of Saint-Jacques, which is still there. A lot of these are little teeny people who are from the center part of France, or the builders, so everybody's aware of this building. And then here you can say, how are we going to get from point one, which is down by the Seine, the Rue de Rivoli, which has been expanded, how do you get to this new opera they're building? Well, first you tip off your friends so they make a lot of money on the deal, knowing what to sell and what to buy. And then you take a ruler, you didn't have to be an architectural genius, you draw a straight line. That's what I mean by imperialism of the straight line. Next, please. You're getting to the opera. And there you can see it rising up. Garnier's opera, it rises up out of the smoke, out of the cloud of destruction. I'm getting carried away. Next, please. And there it's being built. Yeah. And there it is. You are here looking at what now is the largest concentration of pickpockets in the Western world, because there's an American Express right near there. And you see all these Americans, they got their big wallets that say, where's the American Express, dear? Well, it's right over here. Poof! You know, their wallets are out of there before they hit the top step of the metro. And it's baby's gone. There we go. That's the Place Vendôme down there. Next, please. And then there it is in 1900. Here again, imperialism in a straight line. There you've got, I'll do a thing on blowing up this building here a while ago, sometime. We'll come back to this maybe. Anyway, there you go. Now here's the great crossing in the center of Paris. This is your crossing from Ile of Cité here, and you're going up. Here's the Gare de l'Est, the station of the East there. And this way you're looking down east. That's the Tour Saint-Jacques, but what the only point is that they expand this down toward Saint-Antoine, the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, where the revolutionaries were in 1848 and where they were in 1789 and where they were in 1792 as well, and at other times in the French Revolution, 1830, for example. They're down there. So that's the big crossing point, la grande croisée, comme on dit. There's the Gare de l'Est. That's when I see that station. It's so sad because that's where all the people drinking champagne went in 1914, shouting à Berlin. Just as in the Hope Bahnhof in Berlin, they were shouting nach Paris. And of course, they don't come back. And then so many people, Jews, were deported from here. If they weren't sent from the Gare du Nord to Drancy, if they were on the direct line to Auschwitz or the other death camps, they went through this station. Next. Arrested by French police, 1942, 1943. He builds Les Halles, the big market. And I mean, my friend Vincent Scully, who teaches in here afterward, he would do a better job on this. But I do remember since I was, first time I was ever in Paris, I was younger than I once was, and anyway, than I am now, or younger than I'll be, or whatever the line is. And I met somebody on a bus in Germany, and she was a sculptress, and she kindly invited me to stay in her apartment all up and up. It was no real problem. But she took me down in the middle of the night to see this place and to see the restaurants where you could, you know, where you'd see the sort of wealthy people eating, and the butchers with their smocks covered with Beaujolais and also with animal blood. And it was really cool. And then they tore this down. They tore it down to build a whole bunch of unsuccessful places and the, you know, filthy destruction of a monument. We need Vince here to do this. And people chain themselves to these things. They say, can't you leave just one so you people would know what these are like? Can't you leave just one? Say, no, we can make some money here. We can get in, you know, soon we'll have McDonald's all over the place. You know, we'll make some money. And they got rid of, there's none of them left. It's a tragedy. But anyway, Osman built those. I'm not a big Osman guy. But if you, this is right around the corner from us. But here's a building with sort of more Third Republic. But these are the buildings that he built along the boulevards. Next, please. Got to rock it on. If you follow art history, you know there's a very famous painting by Kai Bott that shows the anonymity. It's called Paris with the Effect of Rain. And it's right here on this place, which is where two boulevards come together. And that's part of the thing, too, where you got your basic middle-class people. They were carrying umbrellas. They are disconnected. They would never say hello to each other, and they're crossing this intersection that becomes part of the heartbeat of urban life or something dramatic like that. Next, please. And so you've got these boulevards, and this already existed because it was where the walls had once been. This is the Boulevard Montmartre. Next, please. Oh, man, there's supposed to be another one there. Anyway, no problem, my screw up. If you were flying around overhead, you would look down here. Here's Notre Dame, there's Les Halles up in that direction. There's the Church of Saint-Sulpice. You see the big crossing points, the big boulevards that have been built. Here's the big old crossing point there, the Tour Saint-Jacques. Bird's eye view of all of this. What I left out was a Pizarro of that, Pizarro's image of from that same point where he painted. And the Impressionists painted because of their interest in light and sort of first view and all of that. There's a lot of important paintings of this. So Renoir didn't like these boulevards. He said they look up, they're lined up like troops at a review, and that's the most appropriate image of the centralization of state power. And speaking of state power, what happens in the Paris Commune in 1870 is that 71 is that ordinary people in Paris take arms, as you know, and they build barricades across these places. Next, please. And then the troops of the provisional government from Versailles, appropriately enough, come in and they use these same boulevards, the extension of the Rue de Rivoli, the Rue Saint-Antoine, to go and gun down ordinary people, 25,000 of them. Welcome to the 20th century in 1871. You were guilty for whom you were. À Paris, tout le monde était coupable. Paris, everybody was guilty, said a prosecuting attorney. Next, please. But the spatial aspects of this are important. This is right, that's Madeleine. It's just a lot of destruction. Here's Manet watching his depiction of women being shot. There were these images that rumors that women incendiaries were burning down property, the wealthy buildings of the property. That les pétroleuses, the female incendiaries. And Manet did one, and so did Courbet. Next, please. And finally, that's real death. Those are rather small people in tiny caskets who have just been mowed down because they were who they were. That is poor and in people's Paris. And they systematically targeted areas like Belleville because they were identified with the left. If we could speed through these next few, and then we'll be out of here. Next, please. And here again, those are the boulevards with the old gates. Now, here's what I mean by left, by east-west, that in the northwestern part of Paris, the sort of people were moving into slightly better buildings, and in the northeast, more rural-looking ones just on the outside, the laundry of combat. We know this after 1900 because there's a reference to the metro, and the metro didn't open until 1900, so this is probably about 1912, actually, there. So people on the periphery coming into pawn their mattresses. And here's the gates when you're outside. Again, why are all the factories on the outside, all the ordinary people? Because life was cheaper out there. That's why out beyond Montparnasse are all these cafe areas that are still in Paris now, but were once out there because it was cheaper to be out there. At the end of her sad, short, drunken life, Gervaise in L'Assommoir goes out to hook on the periphery, on the boulevards, as she gets poorer and poorer. Zola was so well aware of the spatial concomitance of all of this. So this is what it was like passing through the barrier. And it's outside that the Red Belt exists. It's outside of all. Vienna is a classic example. In the 1930s, you've got the army blasting, firing cannons against the working class housing perched on the outside of town. Sire said, one of the ministers to Louis Philippe, those usines, those factories that you're allowing to be built on the around Paris, on the outskirts, will be the cord that strangles us one day. And it's on the outskirts, in these industrial suburbs, that had once been producing for, you know, cherries for the urban market and fruit, but now were their factories. It's there that the Communist Party did so well, the 1920s and 1930s and even beyond it, because they provided social services. They defended people, they'll call the mal lotis, people that had no inappropriate places to live. And it was so that, again, was what I mean by center versus periphery. And the sense of not belonging to the center, of not belonging to the center. See, the same thing in people living in the inside of American cities, of not belonging to prosperity, can allow the formation, can contribute to the formation of a contre-société, of kind of a sense of not belonging, creates a sense of belonging. As we are rejected, but we too can become powerful. And the spatial aspects of this are terribly, terribly important. And look at the riots in the suburbs in 2005. We don't have time to talk about that, but that's a fascinating, fascinating thing. Different people who are marginalized by the center, large populations of North Africans and of West Africans and people from the Caribbean. But you see the same phenomenon, center, periphery is there. And last, and I think I've pulled it off, if you went westward, or this is a Monet, this is one of the many regattas at Agnières, you know, you went westward for pleasure, not eastward. And you went further and further. So the middle classes, particularly from the western part of Paris, plant their flag defiantly in Normandy, in Deauville, and in Angouville, and all these places there. And it's there that the Impressionists paint the Parisian upper classes, who, when you go to Deauville, you still see all the 75 license plates and the 78s from the Paris region. It's still the place. So there's a social geography of leisure, too, that develops in Paris, as in these other cities. And it happens so remarkable in what was not only the bourgeois century, not only the rebellious century, but above all, the urban century, where the way in which people lived in very important ways was transformed. Thank you very much. Good luck in the midterm. See you next week. See you on Wednesday.